I asked the computer what the laser's temperature limit was, and it printed out TR-398-734-009-265. Some aspects concerning the adaptability of cryogenic ordnance to use in relatively high-temperature environments. Which had lots of handy advice about how we could insulate the weapons if we had access to a fully equipped armorer's shop. It did note that the response time of automatic aiming devices increased as the temperature increased, and that above some critical temperature, the weapons would not aim at all. But there was no way to predict any individual weapon's behavior, other than to note that the highest critical temperature recorded was 790 degrees, and the lowest was 420 degrees. Charlie was watching the display. His voice was flat over the suit's radio. 16 this time. Surprised? One of the few things we knew about Torin psychology was a certain compulsiveness about numbers, especially primes and powers of two. Let's just hope they don't have 32 left. I queried the computer on this. All it could say was that the cruiser had thus far launched a total of 44 drones, and that some cruisers had been known to carry as many as 128. We had more than a half hour before the drones would strike. I could evacuate everybody to the stasis field, and they would be temporarily safe if one of the Nova bombs got through. Safe, but trapped. How long would it take the crater to cool down if 3 or 4, let alone 16, of the bombs made it through? You couldn't live forever in a fighting suit, even though it recycled everything with remorseless efficiency. 1 week was enough to make you thoroughly miserable. 2 weeks, suicidal. Nobody had ever gone 3 weeks under field conditions. Besides, as a defensive position, the stasis field could be a death trap. The enemy has all the options, since the dome is opaque. The only way you can find out what they're up to is to stick your head out. They didn't have to wade in with primitive weapons unless they were impatient. They could keep the dome saturated with laser fire and wait for you to turn off the generator. Meanwhile, harassing you by throwing spears, rocks, arrows into the dome. You could return fire, but it was pretty futile. Of course, if one man stayed inside the base, the others could wait out the next half hour in the stasis field. If he didn't come get them, they'd know the outside was hot. I chinned the combination that would give me a frequency available to everybody echelon 5 and above. This is Major Mandela. That still sounded like a bad joke. I outlined the situation to them and asked them to tell their troops that everyone in the company was free to move into the stasis field. I would stay behind and come retrieve them if things went well. Not out of nobility, of course. I preferred taking the chance of being vaporized in a nanosecond rather than almost certain slow death under the gray dome.
This ends Disc 7. The F***er War, Disc 8.
I chin Charlie's frequency. You can go, too. I'll take care of things here. No, thanks, he said slowly. I'd just as soon... Hey, look at this. The cruiser had launched another red dot a couple of minutes behind the others. The display is key, identified it as being another drone. That's curious. Superstitious bastards, he said without feeling. It turned out that only 11 people chose to join the 50 who had been ordered into the dome. That shouldn't have surprised me, but it did. As the drones approached, Charlie and I stared at the monitors, carefully not looking at the holograph display, tacitly agreeing that it would be better not to know when they were 1 minute away, 30 seconds, and then, like the other times, it was over before we knew it had started. The screens glared white, and there was a yowl of static, and we were still alive. But this time, there were 15 new holes on the horizon, or closer, and the temperature was rising so fast that the last digit in the readout was an amorphous blur. The number peaked in the high 800s and began to slide back down. We had never seen any of the drones, not during that tiny fraction of a second it took the lasers to aim and fire. But then the 17th one flashed over the horizon, zigzagging crazily, and stopped directly overhead. For an instant it seemed to hover, and then it began to fall. Half the lasers had detected it, and they were firing steadily, but none of them could aim. They were all stuck in their last firing position. It glittered as it dropped, the mirror polish of its sleek hull reflecting the white glow from the craters and the eerie flickering of the constant, impotent laser fire. I heard Charlie take one deep breath, and the drone fell so close you could see spidery Torran numerals etched on the hull and a transparent porthole near the tip. Then its engine flared, and it was suddenly gone. "What the hell?" Charlie said quietly. "The porthole. Maybe reconnaissance." "I guess. So we can't touch them, and they know it. Unless the lasers recover." "Didn't seem likely." "We better get everybody under the dome. Us, too." He said a word whose vowel had changed over the centuries, but whose meaning was clear. "No hurry. Let's see what they do." We waited for several hours. The temperature outside stabilized at 690 degrees, just under the melting point of zinc, I remembered to no purpose, and I tried the manual controls for the lasers, but they were still frozen. "Here they come," Charlie said. "Eight again." I started for the display. "Guess we'll..." "Wait, they aren't drones." The key identified all eight with the legend Troop Carrier. "Guess they want to take the base," he said. "Intact." "That, and maybe try out new weapons and techniques. It's not much of a risk for them. They can always retreat and drop a Nova bomb in our laps." I called Brill and had her go get everybody who was in the stasis field, set them up with the remainder of her platoon as a defensive line, circling around the northeast and northwest quadrants. I'd put the rest of the people on the other half-circle. "I wonder," Charlie said. "Maybe we shouldn't put everyone topside at once, until we know how many Torrens there are." That was a point. Keep a reserve. Let the enemy underestimate our strength. "It's an idea. There might be just 64 of them and 8 carriers. Or 128 or 256. I wished our spy satellites had a finer sense of discrimination. But you can only cram so much into a machine the size of a grape. I decided to let Brill's 70 people be our first line of defense, and ordered them into a ring in the ditches we had made outside the base's perimeter. Everybody else would stay downstairs until needed. If it turned out that the Torrens, either through numbers or new technology, could field an unstoppable force, I'd order everyone into the stasis field. There was a tunnel from the living quarters to the dome, so the people underground could go straight there in safety. The ones in the ditches would have to fall back under fire, if any of them were still alive when I gave the order. I called in Hillebo and had her and Charlie keep watch over the lasers. If they came unstuck, I'd call Brill and her people back, turn on the automatic aiming system again, then sit back and watch the show. But even stuck, the lasers could be useful. Charlie marked the monitors to show where the rays would go. He and Hillebo could fire them manually whenever something moved into a weapon's line of sight. We had about 20 minutes. Brill was walking around the perimeter with her men and women, ordering them into the ditches a squad at a time. setting up overlapping fields of fire. I broke in and asked her to set up the heavy weapons so that they could be used to channel the enemy's advance into the path of the lasers. There wasn't much else to do but wait. I asked Charlie to measure the enemy's progress and try to give us an accurate countdown, then sat at my desk and pulled out a pad to diagram Brill's arrangement and see whether I could improve on it. The cat jumped up on my lap, mewling piteously. He'd evidently been unable to tell one person from the other, suited up. But nobody else ever sat at this desk. I reached up to pet him, and he jumped away. The first line that I drew ripped through four sheets of paper. It had been some time since I'd done any delicate work in a suit. I remembered how in training they'd made us practice controlling the strength amplification circuits by passing eggs from person to person. Messy business. I wondered if they still had eggs on Earth. The diagram completed, I couldn't see any way to add to it. All those reams of theory crammed in my brain. There was plenty of tactical advice about envelopment and encirclement, but from the wrong point of view. If you were the one who was being encircled, you didn't have many options. Sit tight and fight. Respond quickly to enemy concentrations of force, but stay flexible so the enemy can't employ a diversionary force to divert strength from some predictable section of your perimeter. Make full use of air and space support. Always good advice. Keep your head down and your chin up and pray for the cavalry. Hold your position and don't contemplate Dien Bien Phu, the Alamo, the Battle of Hastings. 8 more carriers out, Charlie said. 5 minutes until the first 8 get here. So they were going to attack in 2 waves. At least 2. What would I do in the Torren commander's position? That wasn't too far-fetched. The Torrens lacked imagination in tactics and tended to copy human patterns. The first wave could be a throwaway, a kamikaze attack, to soften us up and evaluate our defenses. Then the second would come in more methodically and finish the job. Or vice versa. The first group would have 20 minutes to get entrenched. Then the second could skip over their heads and hit us hard at one spot, breach the perimeter, and overrun the base. Or maybe they sent out 2 forces simply because 2 was a magic number. Or they could launch only 8 troop carriers at a time. That would be bad, implying that the carriers were large. In different situations, they had used carriers holding as few as 4 troops, or as many as 128. 3 minutes. I stared at the cluster of monitors that showed various sectors of the minefield. If we were lucky, they'd land out there, out of caution, or maybe pass over it low enough to detonate mines. I was feeling vaguely guilty. I was safe in my hole, doodling, ready to start calling out orders. How did those 70 sacrificial lambs feel about their absentee commander? Then I remembered how I had felt about Captain Stott that first mission, when he'd elected to stay safely in orbit while we fought on the ground. The rush of remembered hate was so strong, I had to bite back nausea. Hillebo, can you handle the lasers by yourself?
I don't see why not, sir.
I tossed down the pen and stood up. Charlie, you take over the unit coordination. You can do it as well as I could. I'm going topside.
I wouldn't advise that, sir.
Hell no, William. Don't be an idiot.
I'm not taking orders.
You wouldn't last 10 seconds up there, Charlie said.
I'll take the same chance as everybody else.
Don't you hear what I'm saying? They'll kill you.
The troops? Nonsense. I know they don't like me especially, but...
You haven't listened in on the squad frequencies?
No, they didn't speak my brand of English when they talked among themselves. They think you put them out on the line for punishment, for cowardice, after you told them anyone was free to go into the dome.
Didn't you, sir? Hillebo said.
To punish them? No, of course not. Not consciously. They were just up there when I needed... Hasn't Lieutenant Brill said anything to them?
Not that I've heard, Charlie said. Maybe she has been too busy to tune in. Or she agreed with them.
I'd better get...
There! Hillebo shouted. The first enemy ship was visible in one of the minefield monitors. The others appeared in the next second. They came in from random directions and weren't evenly distributed around the base. Five in the northeast quadrant, and only one in the southwest. I relayed the information to Brill. But we had predicted their logic pretty well. All of them were coming down in the ring of mines. One came close enough to one of the tachyon devices to set it off. The blast caught the rear end of the oddly streamlined craft, causing it to make a complete flip and crash nose first. Side ports opened up, and Torrens came crawling out, 12 of them, probably 4 left inside. If all the others had 16 as well, there were only slightly more of them than of us. In the first wave. The other 7 had landed without incident, and yes, there were 16 each. Brill shuffled a couple of squads to conform to the enemy's troop concentration, and she waited. They moved fast across the minefield, striding in unison, like bow-legged, top-heavy robots, not even breaking stride, when one of them was blown to bits by a mine, which happened 11 times. When they came over the horizon, the reason for their apparently random distribution was obvious. They had analyzed beforehand which approaches would give them the most natural cover, from the rubble that the drones had kicked up. They would be able to get within a couple of kilometers of the base before we got any clear line of sight of them, and their suits had augmentation circuits similar to ours, so they could cover a kilometer in less than a minute. Brill had her troops open fire immediately, probably more for morale than out of any hope of actually hitting the enemy. They probably were getting a few, though it was hard to tell. At least the tachyon rockets did an impressive job of turning boulders into gravel. The Torrens returned fire with some weapon similar to the tachyon rocket. Maybe exactly the same. They rarely found a mark, though. Our people were at and below ground level, and if the rocket didn't hit something, it would keep going on forever. Amen. They did score a hit on one of the gigawatt lasers, though, and the concussion that filtered down to us was strong enough to make me wish we had burrowed a little deeper than 20 meters. The gigawatts weren't doing us any good. The Torrens must have figured out the lines of sight ahead of time, and gave them wide berth. That turned out to be fortunate, because it caused Charlie to let his attention wander from the laser monitors for a moment.
What the hell?
What's that, Charlie? I didn't take my eyes off the monitors, waiting for something to happen.
The ship, the cruiser, it's gone.
I looked at the holograph display. He was right. The only red lights were those that stood for the troop carriers.
Where did it go?
I asked inanely.
Let's play it back.
He programmed the display to go back a couple of minutes and cranked out the scale to where both planet and Collapsar showed on the cube. The cruiser showed up, and with it, 3 green dots. Our coward attacking the cruiser with only 2 drones. But he had a little help from the laws of physics. Instead of going into Collapsar insertion, he had skimmed around the Collapsar field in a slingshot orbit. He had come out going 9/10 of the speed of light. The drones were going 0.99C, headed straight for the enemy cruiser. Our planet was about 1,000 light seconds from the Collapsar, so the Torren ship had only 10 seconds to detect and stop both drones. And at that speed, it didn't matter whether you'd been hit by a Nova bomb or a spitball. The first drone disintegrated the cruiser, and the other one, 0.01 second behind, glided on down to impact on the planet. The fighter missed the planet by a couple of hundred kilometers and hurtled on into space, decelerating with the maximum 25 Gs. He'd be back in a couple of months. But the Torrens weren't going to wait. They were getting close enough to our lines for both sides to start using lasers, but they were also within easy grenade range. A good-sized rock could shield them from laser fire, but the grenades and rockets were slaughtering them. At first, Brill's troops had the overwhelming advantage. Fighting from ditches, they could only be harmed by an occasional lucky shot or an extremely well-aimed grenade, which the Torrens threw by hand, with a range of several hundred meters. Brill had lost four, but it looked as if the Torren force was down to less than half its original size. Eventually, the landscape had been torn up enough so that the bulk of the Torren force was able to fight from holes in the ground. The fighting slowed down to individual laser duels, punctuated occasionally by heavier weapons. But it wasn't smart to use up a tachyon rocket against a single Torren, not with another force of unknown size only a few minutes away. Something had been bothering me about that holographic replay. Now, with the battle's lull, I knew what it was. When that second drone crashed at near light speed, how much damage had it done to the planet? I stepped over to the computer and punched it up, found out how much energy had been released in the collision, and then compared it with geological information in the computer's memory. 20 times as much energy as the most powerful earthquake ever recorded, on a planet three-quarters the size of Earth. On the general frequency. Everybody topside, right now. I palmed the button that would cycle and open the airlock and tunnel that led from administration to the surface.
What the hell, Will?
Earthquake.
How long?
Move. Hillebo and Charlie were right behind me. The cat was sitting on my desk, licking himself unconcernedly. I had an irrational impulse to put him inside my suit, which was the way he'd been carried from the ship to the base, but knew he wouldn't tolerate more than a few minutes of it. Then I had the more reasonable impulse to simply vaporize him with my laser finger. But by then the door was closed, and we were swarming up the ladder. All the way up, and for some time afterward, I was haunted by the image of that helpless animal, trapped under tons of rubble, dying slowly as the air hissed away.
"Safer in the ditches?" Charlie said.
"I don't know," I said. "Never been in an earthquake. Maybe the walls of the ditch would close up and crush us." I was surprised at how dark it was on the surface. S. Doradus had almost set. The monitors had compensated for the low light level. An enemy laser raked across the clearing to our left, making a quick shower of sparks when it flicked by a gigawatt mounting. We hadn't been seen yet. We all decided, yes, it would be safer in the ditches, and made it to the nearest one in three strides. There were four men and women in the ditch, one of them badly wounded, or dead. We scrambled down the ledge, and I turned up my image amplifier to log two to inspect our ditch mates. We were lucky. One was a grenadier, and they also had a rocket launcher. I could just make out the names on their helmets. We were in Brill's ditch, but she hadn't noticed us yet. She was at the opposite end, cautiously peering over the edge, directing two squads in a flanking movement. When they were safely in position, she ducked back down.
"Is that you, Major?"
"That's right," I said cautiously. I wondered whether any of the people in the ditch were among the ones after my scalp.
"What's this about an earthquake?"
She had been told about the cruiser being destroyed, but not about the other drone. I explained it in as few words as possible.
"Nobody's come out of the airlock," she said. "Not yet. I guess they all went into the stasis field."
"Yeah, they were just as close to one as the other. Maybe some of them were still down below, hadn't taken my warning seriously. I chinned the general frequency to check, and then all hell broke loose. The ground dropped away, and then flexed back up, slammed us so hard that we were airborne, tumbling out of the ditch. We flew several meters, going high enough to see the pattern of bright orange and yellow ovals, the craters where Nova bombs had been stopped. I landed on my feet, but the ground was shifting and slithering so much that it was impossible to stay upright. With a basso grinding, I could feel through my suit. The cleared area above our base crumbled and fell in. Part of the stasis field's underside was exposed when the ground subsided. It settled to its new level with aloof grace. Well, minus one cat. I hoped everybody else had time and sense enough to get under the dome. A figure came staggering out of the ditch nearest to me, and I realized with a start that it wasn't human. At that range, my laser burned a hole straight through his helmet. He took two steps and fell over backward. Another helmet peered over the edge of the ditch. I sheared the top of it off before he could raise his weapon. I couldn't get my bearings. The only thing that hadn't changed was the stasis dome, and it looked the same from any angle. The gigawatt lasers were all buried, but one of them had switched on, a brilliant, flickering searchlight that illuminated a swirling cloud of vaporized rock. Obviously, though, I was in enemy territory. I started across the trembling ground toward the dome. I couldn't raise any platoon leaders. All of them but Brill were probably inside the dome. I did get Hillebo and Charlie, told Hillebo to go inside the dome and roust everybody out. If the next wave also had 128, we were going to need everybody. The tremors died down, and I found my way into a friendly ditch. The cook's ditch, in fact, since the only people there were Orban and Rudkoski.
"Looks like you'll have to start from scratch again, Private."
"That's all right, sir. Liver needed a rest."
I got a beep from Hillebo and chinned her on.
"Sir, there were only 10 people there. The rest didn't make it."
"They stayed behind?" Seemed like they'd had plenty of time.
"I don't know, sir."
"Never mind, get me a count. How many people we have, all totaled?" I tried the platoon leader's frequency again, and it was still silent. The three of us watched for enemy laser fire for a couple of minutes, but there was none. Probably waiting for reinforcements. Hillebo called back.
"I only get 53, sir. Some may be unconscious."
"All right, have them sit tight until—"
Then the second wave showed up, the troop carriers roaring over the horizon with their jets pointed our way, decelerating.
"Get some rockets on those bastards!"
Hillebo yelled to everyone in particular. But nobody had managed to stay attached to a rocket launcher while he was being tossed around. No grenade launchers either, and the range was too far for the hand lasers to do any damage. These carriers were 4 or 5 times the size of the ones in the first wave. One of them grounded about a kilometer in front of us, barely stopping long enough to disgorge its troops, of which there were over 50, probably 64. Times 8 made 512. No way we could hold them back.
"Everybody listen. This is Major Mandela."
I tried to keep my voice even and quiet.
"We're going to retreat back into the dome, quickly, but in an orderly way. I know we're scattered all over hell. If you belong to the 2nd or 4th platoon, stay put for a minute and give covering fire while the 1st and 3rd platoons and support fall back. 1st and 3rd and support fall back to about half your present distance from the dome. Then take cover and defend the 2nd and 4th as they come back. They'll go to the edge of the dome and cover you while you come back the rest of the way."
I shouldn't have said retreat. That word wasn't in the book. Retrograde action. There was a lot more retrograde than action. 8 or 9 people were firing, and all the rest were in full flight. Rudkoski and Orban had vanished. I took a few carefully aimed shots, to no great effect, then ran down to the other end of the ditch, climbed out,
and headed for the dome. The Torrens started firing rockets, but most of them seemed to be going too high. I saw two of us get blown away before I got to my halfway point, found a nice big rock, and hid behind it. I peeked out and decided that only two or three of the Torrens were close enough to be even remotely possible laser targets, and the better part of valor would be in not drawing unnecessary attention to myself. I ran the rest of the way to the edge of the field and stopped to return fire. After a couple of shots, I realized that I was just making myself a target. As far as I could see, there was only one other person who was still running toward the dome. A rocket zipped by, so close I could have touched it. I flexed my knees and kicked, and entered the dome in a rather undignified posture. Chapter 7. Inside, I could see the rocket that had missed me drifting lazily through the gloom, rising slightly as it passed through to the other side of the dome. It would vaporize the instant it came out the other side, since all of the kinetic energy it had lost in abruptly slowing down to 16.3 meters per second would come back in the form of heat. Nine people were lying dead, face down, just inside of the field's edge. It wasn't unexpected, though it wasn't the sort of thing you were supposed to tell the troops. Their fighting suits were intact, otherwise they wouldn't have made it this far. But sometime during the past few minutes' rough and tumble, they had damaged the coating of special insulation that protected them from the stasis field. So as soon as they entered the field, all electrical activity in their bodies ceased, which killed them instantly. Also, since no molecule in their bodies could move faster than 16.3 meters per second, they instantly froze solid. Their body temperature stabilized at a cool 0.426 degrees absolute. I decided not to turn any of them over to find out their names. Not yet. We had to get some sort of defensive position worked out before the Torrens came through the dome, if they decided to slug it out rather than wait. With elaborate gestures, I managed to get everybody collected in the center of the field, under the fighter's tail, where the weapons were wrecked. There were plenty of weapons, since we had been prepared to outfit three times this number of people. After giving each person a shield and short sword, I traced a question in the snow. Good archers? Raise hands. I got five volunteers, then picked out three more, so that all the bows would be in use. 20 arrows per bow. They were the most effective long-range weapons we had. The arrows were almost invisible in their slow flight, heavily weighted, and tipped with a deadly sliver of diamond-hard crystal. I arranged the archers in a circle around the fighter. Its landing fins would give them partial protection from missiles coming in from behind, and between each pair of archers put four other people, two spear throwers, one quarterstaff, and a person armed with battle axe and a dozen throwing knives. This arrangement would theoretically take care of the enemy at any range, from the edge of the field to hand-to-hand combat. Actually, at some 600 to 42 odds, they could probably walk in with a rock in each hand, no shields or special weapons, and still beat the shit out of us. Assuming they knew what the stasis field was, their technology seemed up to date in all other respects. For several hours, nothing happened. We got about as bored as anyone could, waiting to die. No one to talk to, nothing to see, but the unchanging gray dome. Gray snow, gray spaceship, and a few identically gray soldiers. Nothing to hear, taste, or smell but yourself. Those of us who still had any interest in the battle were keeping watch on the bottom edge of the dome, waiting for the first Torrens to come through. So it took us a second to realize what was going on when the attack did start. It came from above. A cloud of catapulted darts swarming in through the dome some 30 meters above the ground, headed straight for the center of the hemisphere. The shields were big enough that you could hide most of your body behind them by crouching slightly. The people who saw the darts coming could protect themselves easily. The ones who had their backs to the action, or were just asleep at the switch, had to rely on dumb luck for survival. There was no way to shout a warning, and it took only 3 seconds for a missile to get from the edge of the dome to its center. We were lucky, losing only 5. One of them was an archer, Shubik. I took over her bow and we waited, expecting a ground attack immediately. It didn't come. After a half hour, I went around the circle and explained with gestures that the first thing you were supposed to do if anything happened was to touch the person on your right. He'd do the same, and so on down the line. That might have saved my life. The second dart attack, a couple of hours later, came from behind me. I felt the nudge, slapped the person on my right, turned around, and saw the cloud descending. I got the shield over my head, and they hit a split second later. I set down my bow to pluck 3 darts from the shield, and the ground attack started. It was a weird, impressive sight. Some 300 of them stepped into the field simultaneously, almost shoulder to shoulder around the perimeter of the dome. They advanced in step, each one holding a round shield barely large enough to hide his chest. They were throwing darts, similar to the ones we had been barraged with. I set up the shield in front of me. It had little extensions on the bottom to keep it upright. And with the first arrow I shot, I knew we had a chance. It struck one of them in the center of his shield, went straight through, and penetrated his suit. It was a one-sided massacre. The darts weren't very effective without the element of surprise, but when one came sailing over my head from behind, it did give me a crawly feeling between the shoulder blades.